Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with Dr. Ned Sharpless, director of the UNC Lineberger Cancer Center, about cancer care and prevention in the 21st century. Such an important topic that affects so many of our listeners, and I'm looking forward to hearing what the future will hold.
You know, Christy, I think cancer is still one of those diagnoses that strikes fear in so many people, and everyone has some story to tell. So we'll listen to Dr. Sharpless's story. Maybe we'll add some of our own. But first, we've got some important research that matters about some topics that I think are important. One about treatment of impotence in men.
One about aspirin and its use for preventing heart attacks.
One about, does it matter if the health system you're using has now this comprehensive electronic health record?
And one about mothers holding their newborns before the umbilical cord is clamped.
Well, we're going from soup to nuts here, I think, Christy. But our first research that matters is from the Journal of Sexual Medicine. And it really looks at an important topic, which I see, and I'm sure you do too, a lot in our clinical practices. That is low sexual function or impotence in men.
And a lot of men and a lot of doctors really resort to just jumping to medications, which can be very effective for people. But this is a study looking at some of the non-medication factors to sexual problems and seeing if working on lifestyle change can make a difference.
And what they were really specifically looking at among 800 Australian men from ages 35 to 80, and they looked at them when they first started and then following them up 5 years later, looking at their sexual desire, their sexual activity, self-stimulation with a partner, looking at their ability to maintain or to get an erection, and then looking at their stealth, health and study and habits to see maybe lifestyle, the things that are non-medication, might be just as important to ultimately them being able to maintain or sustain sexual function.
And what they found were that people whose health habits and lifestyle got better, so that's things like losing weight, eating better, getting more active, drinking less alcohol, getting better sleep, that those people tended to see an improvement in their sexual function. And the reverse was also true. Those people who had health habits and lifestyle go down during that time were more likely to experience impotence and other sexual problems.
Yeah, I find this fascinating, Christy, because I think there's a certain expectation and pressure. You know, patients frequently will come in and the men, if they have inadequate sexual function, they're a lot of times they're coming in saying, can I get a prescription for Viagra?
Exactly.
And I think it's much easier to give that prescription for Viagra or Cialis or one of these other Levitra than it is to have this detailed conversation about all the things that are happening in your lives. But it turns out that may be the best thing to do.
Well, and those things, losing weight, eating better, getting more active, not drinking and getting sleep, those also have other health benefits. And so, you know, someone can win in many aspects of their health, including their sexual health.
You just don't want to give that prescription, do you?
Well, I can get the prescription, but the insurance company is going to charge you an arm and a leg and give you only a few, which I think is so weird. But anyway.
Speaking of prescriptions, this next research that matters is about a prescription of aspirin to prevent a first heart attack. Is this something that doctors recommend and is this something that the Food and Drug Administration would recommend on the labeling of aspirin?
So we have, as doctors, been recommending to people who've had a heart attack, stroke, or who have known diseases of the blood vessels in the heart, low-dose aspirin to prevent reoccurrence. That's what's called secondary prevention. So you've already had a problem, take the aspirin, that reduces it happening again. What this is asking is about the benefits for people taking, maybe if you're a man over the age of 50 or just taking a baby aspirin just to prevent the first time you ever have a heart attack.
Like if you maybe have a high blood pressure and your risk of a stroke and risk of heart attack is higher and you smoke, many doctors might recommend to patients that they take a baby aspirin. That data is not as clear-cut as we might like to think. And the Food and Drug Administration, when looking at this, did not recommend that we give these particular medicines in terms of a labeling for people with no history of heart disease.
Exactly. So for primary prevention, which is preventing something before it ever happens, that's where this whole question has, the FDA has concluded that there's not enough data to support the use of aspirin to prevent it the first time. Now, if you're already on aspirin, we're not telling you to stop it. And as a matter of fact, we're saying don't stop it. You should go and talk with your doctor about why you're on it. And if there's a good reason for that, because you are at high risk or you've had a heart attack, then you should certainly stay on it. But if you're on it for just no particular reason, that's something to talk to your doctor about and potentially come off.
Our next Research That Matters, Christy, involves something near and dear to both of us. It's the use of these electronic health records. And I'm not sure we've talked a whole lot, Christy, since you and I both became Epic certified, the large electronic health record system at the University of North Carolina that we both had dozens of hours of training in.
Yay!
And to see, though, this clinical question, which is, does this type of electronic health record or any type of this major electronic health record, can it reduce unnecessary diagnostic or testing?
And specifically, we're talking if hospital systems can talk to each other. If you can get, so what happens is I might get sick and go to the ER at Duke, and then, you know, a few weeks later or a month later, end up in an emergency department down the road at Chapel Hill. Well, the people at one hospital don't have access to what happened at the other. And so you end up getting more CAT scans and more tests done, repeated. And this was a study looking at the difference of how many diagnostic procedures, blood work, imaging tests were avoided when we could exchange information between healthcare systems.
In a six-month period in 2012, they estimated that over 500 potentially duplicate procedures were avoided. Now, the issue in this particular study is all the healthcare hospitals here were affiliated with one healthcare system. So if you go to different healthcare systems, it's unclear whether or not people would have done the time that it would have taken to look into this. But I do think it's really important. I've had patients go 40 miles away to a different health system, Christy, and they had a heart catheterization for the third time in 2 years. And each one, of course, is completely negative. But rather than really look into this, and there is a financial incentive still to bill for things. And so we have to remove some of that financial system. But I have one question for you.
What's that?
Why'd you go to Duke rather than UNC?
Oh, I didn't. I was just telling a story.
Had me scared there for a second, Christy. Let's talk about our last Research That Matters briefly about babies and the clamping in the cord. Do you have to lower that baby because of gravity, keep it down by the vagina, or is it okay to put the baby up on top of the mommy's tummy?
Well, I was blessed to be present for two deliveries just last night, and I'm glad to say that what we did, at least according to the study, is exactly the right thing. So we used to think you had to sort of hold the baby at the level of the vagina, cut that cord as quickly as possible and hand it off. But now we've learned that there's good mom and bonding if you can just place the baby up on the mommy's belly, take your time cutting the cord. And this was a study looking to see if you cut the cord, sort of kept the baby at the level of the vagina versus putting the baby up on the mom, if there was any difference in weight or the amount of placental blood that went to the baby.
And it didn't really show any impact, which really any differences. So it suggests that the practice of putting the baby on top of the mother's tummy is a good thing and perfectly reasonable. I think I still want to get rid of the baby as soon as I can, but that's just me because I don't deliver babies anymore. But I know that is the right thing to do.
There is good bonding and we can promote early breastfeeding. And most moms really want to go ahead and hold their baby after they just went through that experience. So
good thing. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters, Christy. We've had a chance to talk about the mother and the clamping.
And we've talked about sharing information between health systems.
About talking with your doctor about whether or not taking an aspirin to prevent a heart attack or a stroke when you don't have had any of those conditions is needed for you.
And that for many men, impotence is treatable without drugs through losing weight, eating better, getting more active, drinking less alcohol, getting better sleep, and just overall wellness.
We'll take a short break, Christy, but when we return, we'll be talking to Dr. Ned Sharpless, director of the University of North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, about cancer care and prevention in the 21st century. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Ned Sharpless, Director of the University of North Carolina Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, about cancer care and prevention in the 21st century.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Sharpless.
Well, thank you for having me.
You've had a remarkable career, but many of our listeners may not know your success and your passion. Tell us a little bit about your story and what led you to this position.
Sure. I am a local product. I grew up in Greensboro, where I had an undistinguished high school career. And
welcome to the crowd.
And then I, as I think like a lot of kids that age, were trying to figure out what my thing was, and I went to college at the University of North Carolina, where I had a became sort of a mathematician for a while, and I liked that, and that was a lot of fun, but it wasn't sort of the thing I wanted to do with my life's calling. And then I sort of stumbled into medical school at the University of North Carolina, which is a wonderful place to be a medical student. And in particular, they sort of treated everybody with this as if they're in this sort of undifferentiated state that they could turn into anything. And it was during that period that I was exposed to biomedical research, in part through a program through the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, where I went and lived in Bethesda at the NIH for a year and a half. And I was telling people that, you know, within a week of starting in the lab at NIH, I knew that was what I was going to be doing the rest of my life, because it was really, I just loved it from the beginning. I loved everything about it. I loved that I could go in at 3 a.m. and had total control of my schedule. I loved that I knew things that nobody else in the world knew. Some of them were completely unimportant, but yet they were, you know, unique knowledge to me. And I just loved science from the beginning. And so even when I went back to medical school and residency fellowship, I was one of those people who's always sort of sneaking off to the library to read, you know, about science. And then luckily, medicine's a good fit for that. So as I became a doctor, the opportunity to do biomedical research and practice medicine works really well, particularly in oncology. You know, in cancer, the bad news about cancer is we don't do a great job in a lot of patients. But the good news about cancer from a science point of view is that it's very interesting academically. So it's a great career to work in, although, you know, the one has to get used to the difficulty of taking care of patients who all, for the most part, do poorly.
You know, when we talk about in academic medical circles, the triple threat, a doctor who's really good at clinical care and the teaching and the research, you know, you're a triple threat in terms of the scientist and the clinical background that you bring, but also this large administrative role. And I know that we want to talk about your views, because you're exposed not just to your own research, but to the world of research. Did you know at that time how did you decide that also administrative, you know, that you were going to run one of the larger comprehensive cancer centers in the country? When did that come about, that you might be interested in that?
That developed as over a period of years as I sort of ran my own lab and had my own scientific operation. And that's very rewarding and fulfilling, and I still really love that. But at the same time, you know, there's this opportunity to help other people with their research program and to help identify the most promising research programs that it really interested me and excited me. I guess I have this sort of offensive lineman mentality of, I don't really care who gets credit, it's just as long as the ball goes down the field. And so that's really fun as a cancer center director, because one can get involved in other people's projects and help them, you know, get that developed and move to a stage where it can really help people. But it's very collaborative, it's very team-based, and it involves lots of people. And I found I like that. You know, I liked that aspect of cancer research quite a bit. The other thing, the nature of cancer research has changed such that, you know, the individual scientist working on yeast in his own lab, you know, that's still very valuable and important. But most of the stuff that really helps patients is now very, you know, collaborative, large team-based science that involves often multiple institutions, multiple different disciplines of surgeons and radiation oncologists and medical oncologists and, you know, other kinds of doctors. So it became You know, that's the opportunity to have some leadership role in that became very appealing.
Well, the Tar Heels will need some help with their offensive line, so I'm sure you might have another career here.
I'm exactly who they want in their offense.
We've talked about our cancer center and the comprehensive nature of that before, but since we have you on the show, from a patient's perspective, when you hear comprehensive cancer center, how is that different for a patient than going to see a cancer doctor in the private sector or in another setting? What's unique about our cancer center?
Right. So that designation is really provided by the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, which is one of the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. And the NCI designates places as comprehensive cancer centers basically when they kind of have all the facets and features that they consider critical to modern cancer care. So that's really kind of three things in present day. So first, places that are comprehensive cancer centers are centers of clinical excellence, meaning that patients can get the latest and most standard therapy. They're all the newest and most interesting technologies are available to patients, and so they can really get modern state-of-the-art clinical care. Secondly, there has to be sort of a great, you know, basic science drive at the institution, so a cancer biology portion. That's important because, as I mentioned already, we're not really satisfied with the outcomes in cancer patients. Patients with new cancer do much better than they used to. We've made tremendous progress, but we still have a ways to go. And all of us involved in cancer feel like the ability to do new science and make new discoveries is critical to improve progress. I just don't think we have the drugs to cure everyone today, so we need more basic science. And the third part is part that UNC is particularly excellent at is this population sciences outreach portion of it, which is how do you translate cancer work at your institution to the greater population? How do you use it to prevent cancer across your state? What's the most effective way to get people to quit smoking? What's the most effective way to get people to eat right? You know, so there's this implementation piece at a population level that's really an important part and something that the University of North Carolina has always done quite well because of our outstanding School of Public Health. So we have a number of those faculty who are really, really good at this. And that three-legged stool is what makes a comprehensive cancer center. And something that I think, you know, at the University of North Carolina at the Lineberger, we all do all of those things very well.
So when you think about kind of the last 50 years and the next 50 years, you know, what we might have a long discussion about what was one of the great achievements in science and cancer care in the last 50 years. And the first one that just comes into my mind would be a pap smear and our ability to perhaps almost cure but reduce cervical cancer, secondary prevention. But yet we have this new technology like an HPV vaccine that seems to be way underutilized as a preventive therapy. What do we know that's been really successful and what can we take away for the next 50 years? What's going to be our biggest challenge?
Yeah, you know, what's our biggest success? I agree with you. I think the biggest successes in cancer research for the last 50 years have been a lot of them largely epidemiologic, you know, noticing that we can, by screening patients, prevent cervical cancer, and that's been a real success story. I think smoking cessation is becoming a real success story. I mean, your odds of getting certain kinds of cancer are much lower if you don't smoke, and the most common cancer killer of man, lung cancer, is by far smoking associated. So I think that the identification of that as a carcinogen and proving that that can be fixed by stopping smoking is a really major discovery of the 20th century. I think the biological understanding of cancer, you know, the understanding of oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes and the way cancer cells are wired is now settled science and has been used over and over as a paradigm on which to develop new successful therapeutic drugs. And every year now we're having 5-10 molecules FDA approved that work because of this enhanced understanding of cancer. I think an understanding of the immune system and the way it modulates cancer and treats it is the topic for the next 20 years. You know, it's been slow going. It's taken a long time for that idea of immunotherapy, of treating cancers using your immune system to work. But now it's really starting to work. And at the University of North Carolina and many other centers, we're building major efforts around this idea of treating patients' cancers using an immune response as opposed to, you know, classical chemotherapy and cytotoxic drugs. So I think that, you know, it's a very exciting time in cancer research in terms of both, you know, clinical care, population sciences, as well as basic science. And, you know, we're making great progress in all those areas.
Well, Dr. Sharpless, we do need to take a short break. But listeners, stay with us, because when we return, we will continue talking with our guest, Dr. Ned Sharpless, director of UNC Lineberger Cancer Center, about cancer care and prevention in the 21st century. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info. working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Ned Sharpless, director of the UNC Lineberger Cancer Center, about cancer care and prevention in the 21st century. And Dr. Sharpless, before the break, you were sharing with Adam and me and all of our listeners just the benefits of new treatments that you're able to discover and thinking about prevention. In thinking about the newest and most exciting treatments or cures that have come about. You mentioned immunotherapy. Give us an example or a story of how that's impacted someone's life.
Sure. I think the field is moving very quickly. In the old days, we basically treated cancer that was advanced beyond the point where surgery would help with chemotherapy drugs that had a lot of toxicity, and their main problem was they often didn't work very well. And more recently, we've been able to teach the patient's own immune cells to fight the cancer using sort of two approaches. One is to give them these antibodies, these molecules that make their own cells excited and active and go in and take on the tumor directly. And that's been very effective in melanoma and a few other kinds of cancer. A perhaps even more science fiction-y sounding thing is where we take the patient's own cells, their lymphocytes, their T cells, and we grow them out of their body for a few weeks. And during that period, we re-engineer them genetically such that they become sort of new Frankenstein cells, if you will, that are very, very good from the sense that they attack a tumor. And then we give them back to the patient and use that treatment to try and treat advanced cancers that have failed all therapies. And this has been very effective in a few patients, particularly pediatric patients with leukemia. So most pediatric leukemia is actually now cured using standard therapy, but still a significant portion of patients fail standard therapy. And one such patient in the area had received quite aggressive treatment for their leukemia, a young child, but despite that was still left with quite a lot of cancer. And this is a patient we treated at our institution. They then went to the NCI to get these CAR cells, these experimental souped-up ex vivo, you know, T cells, done at the NCI in Bethesda.
National Cancer Institute.
Right, as on part of a clinical trial. That was able to put the patient in remission sufficiently long that they could then get a bone marrow transplant at our institution, where they now appear to be cancer-free over a year later, which is a long time in leukemia. So I think that this kid's likely cured, and this is a disease that was uniformly fatal, 6 months to a year ago. So that's a dramatic change in how we do therapy for that disease.
So you can take the cells out and teach those cells how to fight against the specific cancer.
Yeah, it involves genetic engineering. I mean, it's not a trivial undertaking, but it can be done. And the only bad part about that story, to my mind, is that we had to send this person to NCI because we can't do it locally today. So because of this experience and others, we're building our own facility at UNC, and it's a multi-million dollar investment. It's a very sizable thing to do this because there's an enormous amount of regulatory compliance around such an entity. But we're building a facility so that we can do these sorts of genetically engineered T-cell harvests here and not have to send patients to Washington for the therapy.
You know, I think we'd like to use this technology on some of our learners in the future. But yeah. I do have this question. You mentioned this kind of like science fiction, and you're doing some research that to me is like science fiction. It's really cool. I need you to link together three statements, if you could, Dr. Sharpless. Link together aging in cancer, fireflies, and glowing mice. Okay. If I say those three terms, what do you think of?
I think you might have lost your mind.
I don't know. Have I?
Well, Adam, that happens to be a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. So it turns out the research area of my lab has worked on the relationship between cancer and aging for a long time. And that, I think, unsurprisingly to most people, turns out to be a very intimate relationship. That, you just look at the incidence of most cancers sharply, exponentially increases with aging. So certain cancers are very rare in young people and quite common in old people, like lung cancer and breast cancer, for example. So why that is, though, has never been quite so straightforward. And it's been a lot of molecular biology and, genetics to try and figure that out. And that's something my lab has worked on for the whole extent of my scientific career. And one thing that we did recently to try and address this question was to create a kind of mouse that's what we call a reporter mouse. Means it has a feature about it that makes it very easy to tell when, in this case, it's getting old in molecular terms. So these mice, when they get old, they glow. And they glow because they've had this firefly gene put into their DNA, into their germline DNA, such that when they become aged, this firefly gene becomes activated. And when given a chemical that fireflies make, they will glow brightly. And so what's cool about that is then you can then see, sort of see how old the mouse is, not in chronologic terms, you know, not how many weeks it's been alive or months it's been alive, but you can see how old it is in molecular terms. And the reason that's interesting is if you think about it, there are lots of things that seem to accelerate our physiologic age such that, you know, the driver's license test of how old two people are is not perfect. So, you know, the sort of first thing we do in medical school is we're taught to say, you know, Mr. Smith is a 50-year-old man who looks older or looks younger than stated age. That's the beginning of the, you know, the history and physical that we all do since third year of medical school. And so the idea that physiologic age is not a perfect marker or is not directly correlated with chronologic age is common to physicians. You know, we do things to some 60-year-olds and they fly through it and they're jogging the Boston Marathon a week later, and other 60-year-olds have terrible toxicity and never recover. And so some understanding of how someone's, you know, molecular physiologic age is measured would be very useful in clinical medicine. And so this mouse was an effort to do that. It was an effort to make a sort of glowing, aging reporter mouse, and it actually works remarkably well.
And then can you do different things to those mice, like put them, have them smoking cigarettes?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You can do that exactly.
Have them eat a really fatty diet and then see what happens to the age of their cells?
So we've done that. So smoking is a – and in fact, we call things that – you know, things that cause cancer, we call those carcinogens.
Uh-huh.
Things that accelerate aging, we call gerontogens. So gerontology, geriatrics, gerontogen. Right? So we're looking for chemical gerontogens that accelerate aging. The best example by far and clearly the most important from a public health standpoint is cigarette smoking. So tobacco is a very potent gerontogen that will make the mice glow in a very obvious way very quickly. So short exposures of tobacco, a few weeks of a passive inhalation of cigarette smoke will make a mouse older molecularly in very short order.
Really?
High-fat diet had surprisingly little effect on mice. But, you know, mice don't get diabetes. They don't get a lot of the things. They'll get very, very obese, but they won't have a lot of the problems that humans have with obesity. So I'm not sure how good a model mouse overfeeding is for human obesity. But in any event, it had no effect on this marker of molecular age. We've tried other things like arsenic, which is a big problem in eastern North Carolina, arsenic in drinking water and in well water. So we've looked at that, and that has a modest effect that's not nearly as impressive as cigarette smoke. UV light has a very strong effect on cutaneous aging. So if mice are sunburned, they will have a quite obvious increase in their molecular age within short order. But the good part about this is, and by the way, it's not my lab's interest to try and rattle through every chemical and compound in the environment, but we're hoping to make these mice, and have in fact made these mice, widely available to other investigators so that the, you know, arsenic experts can try arsenic and the, you know, radiation experts can try radioactivity and the, you know, whatever your favorite candidate chemical is that promotes that might promote aging, you can test using this model system in short order.
Well, you know, talk about making gerontogen. Gerontogen. That sounds like a dinosaur, and I know that we're trying to make like cancer history, and so they said, you know, the dinosaur smoking is what made them extinct. But I wonder if you think about into your role as director of the Cancer Center, and tell our audience about the University Cancer Research Fund. Is this unique to North Carolina? Is this something other states should do? And is it all part of trying to make cancer history to essentially get you out of a job?
Right. Well, that would be great, although I think we'd find something else to do. You know, the University Cancer Research Fund is a really interesting effort by the state of North Carolina to and it provides a significant amount of state funding for cancer research at the University of North Carolina. This year it was $42 million. It's mostly funded from a tobacco tax on non smokeless tobacco, so non-smoked tobacco, so, you know, snuff and things like that. And, you know, $42 million for research is a lot of money. We have, I think, done really terrific things with the funding at the University of North Carolina. The UCRF is in its seventh year now. As to whether other states should do it, many states do something like this. So state funding for cancer research is pretty common, although generally not this much. So it's usually more in the sort of $10 to $20 million range. Many states have used their tobacco settlement money for cancer research. Other states have, you know, certain dedicated taxes like we do. The largest state effort to fund cancer research is clearly in the state of Texas, which has this program to do $3 billion over 10 years. It's called CPRIT, so $300 million a year. I think that program has been very successful. You know, basically states have decided that cancer is a big problem for them. It contributes to the decreased health of their citizens. It costs them a lot of money in terms of Medicaid shortfalls every year, and they want to try and do something about it. Clearly, our state also believes it's good. It's a form of economic development, that by funding cancer research, that'll bring new intellectual property and new companies and new jobs and things like that to the area. And I think that has actually been true as well. And we have good data to support that at the University of North Carolina. So I think it's a great idea. I think the way North Carolina has chosen to do it is particularly wise, because it's efficient. It doesn't create a new unwieldy infrastructure that's hard to manage. And I think we'll see more of this. You know, states beginning to pick ideas that they believe are really important for dedicated research, and cancer has been a popular one throughout the country.
So considering the amount of funding and energy and bright minds that are going into cancer care and prevention over this next century, what do you think are the key, as you have your crystal ball of looking into the future, what are the key developments that will happen that will change the face of cancer care and prevention?
Right. Well, I think we've touched on some of them already. I believe, you know, there'll be a number of developments in terms of new therapies. So we talked about immunotherapy and monoclonal antibodies and specialized small molecule drugs, and all of those things are looking very promising. I think that the interaction between cancer and aging really is a topic for the 21st century. It's the demographics of the United States are aging, such that the average age of the population is increasing. And therefore, understanding these specialized issues of cancer care and geriatric populations has become a very, very important topic. We have a world leader in that regard at the University of North Carolina, which is Dr. Hai Musse, who specifically studies that question of breast cancer in women. I think we will see more and more time as tobacco use declines. I think we'll spend more and more time on the importance of diet and cancer. And that's really a sort of topic for the 21st century. I think our sort of systems to study that have been quite poor until recently, but have improved greatly. And I expect we'll really start to see specific linkages between certain dietary components and cancer outcome.
And in your science fiction world, will cancer be part of history?
Oh, I think we'll continue to do much better against cancer than we've been doing in the past. You know, so one other issue, I admitted a fourth area, which is this sort of emerging field of regenerative medicine, where, you know, so if you can just wipe out someone's bone marrow and give them a new bone marrow, you can cure their leukemia much more easily, right? So I think that the ability to sort of come up with replacement tissues and replacement cells after high-dose treatments will really impact cancer care in a very dramatic way.
It's exciting.
So it's science fiction, but it's here today.
Well, you know, we appreciate you being here with us today talking about cancer care. We could really go on, and we have to have you back, because the cost of care, the outcomes of care, the how we deliver the care, all of these things are really quite important. We actually had Hai Musse on our show a year or two ago. Great, great researcher. I agree with that fully. Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Ned Sharpless, Director of the University of North Carolina Comprehensive Leinberger Cancer Center, for being our guest today and really giving us hope in an area that's oftentimes frightening.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Dr. Sharpless.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
Christy, we have a lot of listeners with a lot of really interesting health problems and concerns, and they can send them to us, and we'll talk about them on any upcoming show. Send them to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first House Call question of the day.
I work primarily as a carpenter, and the other day I thought I had a splinter in my finger and tried to take it out, but I couldn't find anything. The next day, my finger started to swell. I emailed my doctor, and she told me I needed to begin strong antibiotics immediately. I was really impressed with her use of technology when she responded quickly to a picture and email I sent her, as well as having my prescription called in to my pharmacist within 1 hour. I want to applaud new systems like this. It really improves care.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That wasn't our doing, but we appreciate hearing anything good about getting good care.
Yeah, and I have noticed our new electronic system, Epic, that we've been talking about, has made it easier to communicate with our patients and to let patients see their lab results online. And there are just a lot of benefits that I think will help connect us and communicate more efficiently with our patients.
You know, the good side is that it sounds like that in this case you got better. The difficult part is sometimes we don't want to substitute sometimes electronic communication for in-person communication. So I sometimes would worry a little bit about in this particular situation, which a finger infection can be so serious.
Yes.
And you could really be hospitalized. And so, you know, I would really encourage you to make it part of your care, but don't make us dependent on that care.
I would agree with that, Adam. Let's take our next house call question.
Good. Erica?
A friend of mine told me that he has cancer of the rectum. This is really shocking. He told me he had warts many years ago, but they had never caused him any symptoms. Were warts the cause of his cancer?
Sorry to hear about your friend, and it's just unfortunate to have rectal cancer. You know, in terms of warts, the kinds of genital warts can increase one's risk for cervical cancer in women. But most rectal cancers are related to other risk factors like age and smoking or family history of colon or rectal cancer. Some certain elements in the diet can be linked. Or if a person has polyps or those sort of pre-cancer growths that happen in the colon, which is why we have colonoscopies to try to screen for and remove those before they become cancer. But sometimes it can happen just sort of out of the blue, and we don't have a good explanation for why that happens.
You know, in this particular case, you know, we couldn't rule it out that it's not related. As Chrissy says, common things happen commonly, uncommon things happen uncommonly. But you know what? This would be a good advice for all of us, that if we have a disease, no matter what it is, we should try to get it treated and be followed. There's higher risk associated with these warts and being exposed to these warts. And if they're around the rectum, there may be a certain sexual activity that put this person at higher risk as well. So these things are concerning. But we hope that he does well and gets really good treatment.
And for our listeners out there, if you are 50 or older, or if you have a family history of colon cancer, maybe even if you're younger, talk to your doctor. Go ahead and get your colonoscopy to try to prevent colon cancer before it happens.
Erica, what's our very next house call?
When your blood pressure is really high and you have a headache, how do you decide if your blood pressure is causing the headache or vice versa?
Chicken or
now,
the
wait,
egg?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is worth a lot of money to answer this question, and I'm not sure we can do it justice. But a great question.
It is, and I have seen both things in my patients where their blood pressure goes up and they don't feel well, and that gives them a little bit of a headache or a pounding kind of a headache. But I've also had people who have bad headaches, and when they get a bad headache, you're in pain, then it can make your blood pressure go up.
And I guess the real question a lot of times we have is, you know, do you check your blood pressure all the time and it's under really good control, and then all of a sudden you get a headache and it's under bad control? That would make it seem like it's probably due to the headache, not the other way around. But if your blood pressure has been running really high for a long time and then it goes up even higher and then you get a headache and you don't usually have headaches, well, that'd make me think it's due to the blood pressure. But regardless, we're going to take it seriously. We're going to try to relieve your pain. We're going to try to get your blood pressure down. Both things are happened simultaneously lots of times.
It is important to get that blood pressure down.
Erica, what's our very last house call?
I'm 25 and can never remember going to the dentist, ever. People tell me all the time that I have a great smile. But over the last 4 weeks, I've had a nonstop pain in my tooth. I don't have dental insurance, and it's hard to find a dentist where I am. Can my primary care provider help?
Oh, this is also a big question of access to dental care and trying to figure out insurance coverage and cost as a piece of this. The best person to see when you have, especially if something's been going on that long, is your dentist. But if you have a primary care provider and that's easier, that person's easier to get into, then I think it's very appropriate for you to go there. The primary doctor might be able to help you at least look to see if there's an abscess or infection or something that's visible, maybe help you with pain medicines or antibiotics as you're getting in to see the dentist.
Christy, I think that you said it exactly correct.
I was like, I thought you were going to be like, and I disagree with you.
No, I think that dental abscesses need treatment. They need to see a dentist. They need the primary care doctor has a role to play. It's a team.
It is a team, but really working to get in with a dentist is the right thing to do. And you can ask about cost and insurance and those things, but if you have a big infection down there, it needs to be treated.
Well, that'll conclude House Calls today, and we want to thank our listeners for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you, and you can visit us online to find out more at yourhealthradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Ned Sharpless. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.